Thank you for coming. I know a lot of you are probably anxious to get out of San Francisco and back to where you are, so I appreciate your being here. First of all, the disclaimer, the presenter disclosures, neither Kimmy Watkins Hart, Wright Lassiter, Tomas Magana, nor I have any relationship to declare. I'm going to first go over a little bit of a little bit about Cuba, a little bit about Medic, and then a lot about what these people, who all of whom you've met in the video, have done since coming back. Turn it over to them to talk about that. First of all, medical education cooperation with Cuba, in a nutshell, provides visibility and credibility to the Cuban healthcare system. Cuba's powerful message is that political will, not wealth, is the key to transforming health. We have many programs, and I invite you to go to our booth, whose number I can't remember. 2719, thank you. We have a lot of material and some people there that can tell you. We support the U.S. students who are in the Latin American Medical School in Cuba. We've produced a feature-length film, Salud, which I hope a lot of you have seen. We have a peer-reviewed journal called Medic Review, and we do exchanges in Cuba for health professionals. The program I'm going to talk about, and everyone's going to talk about, is Community Partnerships for Health Equity, and I'm going to get back to that in a minute. But first of all, why Cuba? How many of you have been to Cuba in this audience? I think a fair number. Okay. So I'm going to just do Cuba 101 in 2 seconds. Cuba has first world health statistics, and it's a developing country. The gross national income per capita is more like Honduras, but it's life expectancy, infant mortality, and other health outcomes are more like the United States and Canada. They also spend considerably less on health care than we do, with better results. This is a billboard I especially like. 25,000 children in the world die each day from curable diseases, and not one of them is Cuban. They were the first nation to eradicate polio, and they have the lowest HIV/AIDS rate in the hemisphere. The leading causes of death are exactly the same as ours. They like to say we live like poor people and we die like rich people. These are the principles written into the Constitution of the of Cuba. Health is a human right, access, it's free, it's the government's responsibility. There's a focus on primary care with an emphasis on public health and prevention, and always with community involvement. Now, back to this program, which was somewhat daring, I think, on our part, but it was to take community leaders from a given geographic area to go to Cuba, see what they could learn, see what they could bring back, and adapt to our system. There are many good people working on all kinds of wonderful projects, but we thought maybe they could get some inspiration, information, and stimulation by seeing the Cuban models. So since 2006, 100 participants from 3 communities have participated. They've gone over a 2 to 3 year period each. These are South Los Angeles, Oakland, and Albuquerque. These are the key take-homes from these participants in all 3 communities. Prevention, prevention, prevention. Medicine and public health are not separate. Neighborhood access to health. A very vigorous data collection and continuous needs assessment. Targeted intervention by risk stratification. That's the dispensarización that Kimmy was finally able to pronounce. Cross-sector coalitions. Health is not just the responsible of hospitals. Socially accountable medical training. So the participants are going to talk about how they've applied one or all of these in their situations. The healthcare system, in a nutshell, is a pyramid. On the bottom are consultorios, which are basically doctor-nurse offices, which have a catchment area of 1,500 to 2,000 people. Everybody can just walk to their consultorio. The polyclinic is the next level, which is more like our clinics with laboratory and diagnostic equipment and specialists. The local hospital is the next, up to the municipal and provincial hospitals, and then to the specialized research institutes. This is a picture. The consultorio on the bottom, the doctor lives either upstairs or next door to the consultorio, and the nurse as well. So the doctor is a member of the community. Cubans say that 80 to 85% of healthcare is done at the community level. They do home visits. They have specialists, actually visit the consultorios once a week. They have community groups that are associated with health education and health promotion. And they require every medical student, every graduate, to go through a family medicine resident prior to doing another residency. This is a map of an area with consultorios. This is the polyclinic director. And this is a list in handwriting of every consultorio in that area. The dispensarización is actually a grouping of all patients into four categories: healthy, at risk, chronic disease, and group four, complications of chronic disease. These are people who often stay at home, who maybe should be in the hospital, but the family doctor team can do home visits. And it's by really knowing an area, what are the prevalent problems in one's area, that doctors and nurses are able to keep track and really target not only intervention but health education. The other really important thing about Cuba is their medical education. Again, if you go to our booth, you can learn more about it, and I think both two of our participants are going to talk about this. The Latin American Medical School was formed because there's really a lack of doctors in developing countries. So it was formed originally after Hurricane Mitch, when Cuban doctors went to help out, like a lot of us did, in Central and Latin America, and came back saying, this is just the tip of the iceberg. The hurricane is one problem, but the big problem is that there are no doctors when we leave. So they opened this this medical school, which is now the largest in the world. It offers full scholarships to 10,000 students, 200 of which are U.S. students going to school in Cuba. They graduate fully bilingual, with a real sense of social accountability. We've added a new element of the Community Partnerships for Health Equity, where we have a Cuban consultant identified with each group. This is the group in Albuquerque. On the right is Dr. Pastor Castell, who is the dean of the School of Public Health in Cuba. The Albuquerque group is now at a stage that the Oakland group was 2 years ago. They've been to Cuba twice. They're working on a strategic plan to really do something in Albuquerque. Looking ahead, Medic anticipates forming a network of 10 or more CPHEs throughout the U.S. who are learning from Cuba and from each other. And with our nation's health in crisis, it's time to break the Cuban taboo and learn from a good example. And this is a quote from Jerry Spiegel, who's a researcher of Cuba. And I just want to say, the little video that you saw was made in 2008 when these Oakland Alameda people had just come back. They'd been three times to Cuba. And now, 4 years later, they've actually progressed to doing some things in Oakland, which I find very exhilarating. So I'm going to turn it over to Kimmy Watkins-Tart of Alameda County Public Health Department. Good morning. Here's what we know. In Alameda County, as in many counties, we do not have sufficient access to primary and preventive care. Healthcare costs are rising, people are waiting longer periods of time to address basic health needs, and this usually results in residents addressing care in the highest cost settings. What we also know is that there are many factors that contribute to one's health status as well as life expectancy. Many of you may have seen this slide earlier in the week, but if you are an African-American child born in West Oakland, which is right across the bridge from here, you are more likely to be born premature, low birth weight, more likely to be born into poverty. As a child, you're more than two times more likely to have been behind in your vaccinations and less likely to be reading at grade level. By the time you reach adulthood, you're five times more likely to be hospitalized for diabetes and two times more likely to die of heart disease. These health and social factors are likely to result in you dying 15 years earlier than your white peers in the Oakland Hills, which is less than 3 miles away from your home. To address the inequities that I described in the previous slide, we believe it's important to take a comprehensive approach. Much of the recent work in our public health department in Alameda County has centered on extending our reach into the root causes of poor health. And at the same time, we have a myriad of services that fall inside of the medical model. These services are critical and they need to be improved. This includes access to high quality care. In our travels to Cuba, as Diane mentioned, and as well as you saw in the video, we had an opportunity to see what it looks like to have a completely integrated system. And that a system that includes all levels of prevention. While we're not able to entirely replicate their healthcare system here, we have been successful in creating parts to make it appear or be more like a complete health system. Because of our primary care settings are severely impacted, causing patients at times to wait months for care, we have begun to develop a new layer in our system in Alameda County, and this layer encompasses our portals. Portals in Alameda County are points of entry for residents to receive basic medical care and support services. The portals in our county sit between the primary medical home and the upstream prevention that happens in neighborhoods and our policy work. The portals take a variety of different forms, some of which were described by our agency director in the video. These are designed to fit inside of the community that they're situated in, as well as some of the portals are designed for specific populations. In Alameda County, we're committed to building quality systems that are guided by a variety of factors. Some of those include cultural competence, partnerships, and of course, data. This is especially the case for our school-based health centers, where we have had over a decade of experience providing services to the community. In our county, this is a map showing the location of some of our school-based health centers. Currently, we have 24 school-based and or community-based health centers for youth and young adults. And these centers are located at high schools, middle schools, youth centers, and recently community colleges. There are three main programs for our school health services portals, and they include a continuum of age-appropriate integrated health and wellness services for youth and young adults that are provided in safe, youth, and young adult-friendly environments
either in schools or near schools. School-based behavioral health services is also a component which provides the social and emotional development that all students need. Building on collaborative work with schools, school districts, and providers to transform into community hubs that bring together multiple partners to support our youth and young adults. This is an example of the type of staffing and hours of a typical school-based health center. All school-based health centers don't have the same exact staffing configuration, but all of them would include, of course, a director, a receptionist of some sort, a person to do data entry and billing, a nurse practitioner, medical assistant, a mental health provider, as well as someone to coordinate health education. In some settings, you'd also have volunteers and interns, and at some of the schools, particularly in the schools, in the middle schools, you might also have school nurses. In our community, as in lots of communities around the country, school nurses are vanishing, and so at the high school level, you very rarely would see a school nurse. The next type of portal that I want to talk about are day labor centers. There are currently two day labor centers operating in our county, one in Oakland and one that has recently begun in Hayward. They're designed to provide basic health care and social services for medically indigent immigrant and our migrant populations who congregate in certain areas of our community looking for day work. Day labor centers provide basic health screenings and treatment, culturally and linguistically competent support, and linkages to needed support services. A new project that we're working on right now is what we're calling the Trust Clinic. And this is going to be run by the Public Health Department out of our Healthcare for the Homeless program. We're currently outfitting a new portal, which will be designed for adults who are homeless and or unemployed and disabled. Our clients are individuals who are believed to be unemployable and currently receiving general assistance from the county. The Trust Clinic, the goal of the Trust Clinic and the SSI Trust is to assist unemployable adults with disabilities with primary care, mental health, substance abuse services, housing, legal advocacy, as well as the assistance in applying for SSI or Social Security insurance. The Trust Clinic is a collaboration between Healthcare for the Homeless, which is part of our Public Health Department, the County Social Services Agency, Behavioral Health Care Services, three nonprofit community-based organizations that provide legal services to people who are trying to get SSI benefits. The Trust Clinic, like most of the portals, is a transitional medical home, not a full-service primary care home. After a client has been approved for SSI, which can take up to 18 months, it is our intention to connect them to a primary medical home. Linkage to a primary medical home, of course, is going to have to begin at intake, and is a part of building the client's capacity to navigate our health system. Last, I would like to discuss the fire station portals. This is a new and innovative model that would build upon the expertise of our safety net providers, emergency medical system, and community-based organizations. The services will include low acuity primary care visits, preventive care, and health screening, sports physicals, and immunizations. As with all the portals, services will be customized to the communities and or populations that they're serving. These portals have not gotten fully off the ground yet. They're still in planning. We also plan on the fire station portals being sites where individuals can receive navigation services for linkages to insurance programs as well as medical homes. Follow-up and support services for residents within 48 hours of discharge from local hospitals, if that is needed, as well as accepting direct referrals from 211 line for medical advice and or consultation. And this is a drawing of what we envision a portal at a fire station would look like. It's also our hope that as a part of the portals in our county, we would be able to really implement dispensarización and be able to use the data based on assessments of the community surrounding that particular site. We're closer to being able to do that at the school-based health centers, and so a lot of information is collected in not only the school setting, but in the neighborhood around the school to begin to anticipate, okay, what are the needs of the residents in the area? And so maybe a couple of years from now, we'll be further along and we'll have everything in place. Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
How's everyone doing this morning? So, you know, I am hoping just to share with you a few perspectives from the lead of our public hospital system around how our visits to Cuba, both my own personal visits, but more importantly, frankly, the visits of a lot of caregivers and the folks you see to my right, how that's really impacted us and changed quite a bit of our perspective. I would tell you just as full disclosure, so I was initially a naysayer. I was a non-believer. I heard these stories of people going to Cuba, and frankly, I was puzzled as to why are they going to Cuba? Like, what are they learning? And I sent a few of our docs, and our docs told me they were going, and you know, I supported it, but I sort of thought, I'm not sure why we're doing this. And every time they would come back, I would go and listen to the debrief. And the first time I listened, I was blown away by what they were telling me. I sort of thought, surely that can't be true. And I went again to the next visit and heard the report. And after that, I was sold and saying, okay, I'm going on the next trip to Cuba because I've got to see this for myself. So just really quickly to sort of talk about who we are. So I'm the CEO of Alameda County Medical Center, and we're the safety net organization for Alameda County. And so we've got three hospitals, and I won't read all this stuff to you, but it just kind of gives you a quick sense of who we are. We've got not quite 500 beds across our three hospitals and lots of docs. We're really known for doing the thing that's not emphasized in Cuba, which is doing interventional stuff, ER, trauma, high-end stuff. You know, we're known for intervening after the fact. And Cuba is really good at intervening well before the fact, and so this is a journey that we're on and trying to reorient how we do what we do. We do a lot of training, and so as you'll hear a little bit later, the partnership around training students and giving them access to our organization is something that's part of our DNA because we train lots of folks. But as you heard in the video, a lot of folks were giving me kudos for opening up our health system to these students. And I said to them, really, thank you for that, but this is not completely altruistic because we are gleaning lots of gems from you. And so it's been a great experience for us. Again, we're structured like a traditional public health system in that we have, you know, clinics out in the community and we have hospitals and we provide just about anything and everything that a patient might need. The problem is we've been really oriented around the hospitals historically and not oriented around primary care, preventative care. And so what Cuba is teaching us much more is the importance of doing much more of that. We just show you very quickly at this slide sort of where we're located. And so many of you may not be from this community, and so this is Alameda County. And on the left side of the screen, what you would see is the bay. And then our county extends out to the east. And so we have facilities that are principally Bayside, and those facilities have to integrate well with what Kimmy just mentioned in terms of public health clinics, school-based clinics, and then a network of other FQHCs that aren't part of either the county's public health system or part of the public hospital system, but are out in the community serving diverse populations throughout Alameda County. So to give you, this is a photo of a group. I think this was group three that went on the trip. I want to give you some personal reflections, and you've heard a few already in the video and a few of my opening comments. But as I said, you know, I initially was unsure of why we'd be sending people to Cuba, and was pleasantly surprised that there was so much richness there. Diane gave me the typical medic spiel, what medic's all about and what was medic trying to accomplish, and I listened and I heard her and I thought it sounded great, but I was just not sure of the source that was going to give us all this wonderful information. And what we found is, frankly, you know, bullet point two, I think, is probably the most meaningful, which I've been sort of spreading since getting involved, which is Cuba's approach can absolutely, absolutely and fundamentally change how the U.S. approaches healthcare, unequivocally, and hopefully can help us locally improve access, because we're not sort of thinking about our healthcare system the way that we traditionally do, which is put up a big building, a really big building, particularly in the safety net. You know, you do really big buildings, oftentimes not in people's communities, and you wonder why you have access problems. And so this sort of notion of consultarios in a community where healthcare is not a destination, it is part of the community, is something that is so foreign to us, but it's so common in Cuba, and it seems like a very simple thing, but that, in my mind, is one of the things that makes this so important. One of the other reasons why it's important to travel, as I mentioned, is that teaching is in the DNA of our healthcare system, and so we educate lots of folks, and so the opportunity to partner with Bay Area students who are trying to pursue medicine for all the right reasons, pursuing medicine because they really want to impact their community, and they want to do that in a very meaningful way, is something that's really, really powerful. And so we'll just share a few lessons that we've learned and that we're trying to implement. You know, population health is all the rage now, with lots of organizations that are trying to focus on medical homes and longitudinal care management and chronic disease management. And so we are doing the same thing. We're actually taking the principles of the dispensarización concept and trying to do it ourselves. We actually are now having all of our medical home managers put patients into four tiers and are trying to focus on, you know, which tier are they in, and then how do we assign resources based upon stratification. And so it's something that we brought back very specifically from Cuba. And frankly, during our summer interns, which I'll mention in a second, we've really tried to harvest knowledge from the ELOM students to help us in developing this approach. And so clearly, in a system like ours, where we have lots of patients, and we at times lament, you know, inadequate resources. I show a lot of our teams photos of Cuba. And I say to them, so the day that you want to complain about what you don't have, take a look at what these folks are doing with a tenth of the resources you have and maybe five times the production that we do. And so that always seems to put things in context. So we are, while it is wildly important for us to focus on prevention and to focus on wellness, we also know that because of the deficiencies of our healthcare system, we have vast numbers of individuals that have very complex diseases because we, frankly, didn't intervene upstream. But now we have to manage them well, and we do a really poor job of managing complex patients. And so one of the things that as we begin sort of thinking through how might we use some of the lessons from Cuba, one of the things that we have implemented beginning just very, very recently is a complex care system where we're trying to focus on placing resources to truly manage people with very, very complex diseases, so we get them out of the emergency departments, we get them out of the revolving door of hospitals, you know, every 30 days or more. And so it is one of the things that is helping us immensely. We're opening a brand new specialty care center very soon, and our complex care center will be one of the hallmarks of our specialty care center. I'm going to keep moving, though, as I got my sign, my hook, make sure I don't get the hook and save time for Tomas. Also wanted to share a few more things that we're attempting to do to integrate the Cuban principles into our system. And as Kimmy mentioned, and I think frankly one of our weaknesses has been that we had a very competent public health system. We had a very robust FQHC network, We had a very hardworking, safety net healthcare system, but at times we were doing all those things in separate universes and not understanding the need for integration and bringing those circles together. And so we're spending quite a bit of time starting with relying on the data from the public health system to help us drive outcomes, help us drive how do we pair resources where the community needs it. And I think, frankly, that has been a significant benefit to us. I want to just share a couple comments before I close on supporting the summer program. We've had a number of students through our system over the last four summers, and we'll tell you that the knowledge that those young folks impart on our senior physicians has been really remarkable. Our docs, I think, enjoy it more than the students do because it's a breath of fresh air. It's a change in perspective. It's sort of taking the pyramid and flipping it on its point to help us improve how we teach. And I'll tell you that when I was there, I was there in 2010. We were in Cuba the Sunday when President Obama signed the Affordable Care Act. And we were sort of cheering, in a bar, at a bar, and people sort of looked at us as we told them why we were celebrating, and they looked at us like we were from Mars. You mean you guys don't have universal health care? You mean your country doesn't believe that health care is a right? And so I would just tell you that I do all these things that we've been doing in supporting the summer program, in supporting Elon, and supporting Medic, frankly, because if we're going to get a country that is going to really thrive, that will provide for its residents the kind of life that you need, people must be healthy. And so what we've learned from Elon, what we've learned from Medic, what we've learned from the students, what we've learned from the Cuban system effectively is they're doing a much better job of ensuring that every resident has access to high-quality health care. They're doing it at a cost that's less than ours. And they're doing with outcomes that mirror ours. I'll sort of close on this, show you this slide, a quote from one of our students. And she sort of talks about primary care being an intersection of individual health and the healthy functioning of society. And I love this. I wish we could send this to Washington when they're debating whether health care is important to this country or not. It's the intersection between an individual's health and healthy functioning of society. And I think when our society decides that this intersection really makes sense, we'll be able to do as much as we should be able to do for every member of this community. So thank you.
Good morning. My name is Tomas Magaña. I'm a pediatrician based in Oakland. I've been serving the community there for the past 16 years and predominantly the at-risk youth population in that. So the sense of health disparity and health inequity is part of my daily experience. I actually participated on the trip with Wright. I was there at the bar when that announcement was made. And I remember that sense of jubilation when we heard it. It was an extraordinary moment. But I really participated on that trip because I wanted to get two primary experiences. I wanted to understand how an integrated healthcare system works after working in a fragmented system, or rather lack of system in this country, and how it plays out. And I also wanted to understand how they address this notion of medical education, because that is a big part of what my professional priorities are. So I'm going to talk with you a little bit about some of the lessons I learned. And I'm going to talk about a different part of what we refer to as access. We've already heard a little bit about the portals of entry, so institutions which allow services to happen. But the problem is, if you don't have people to deliver the care in a culturally responsive and competent way, it just creates a whole other level of barriers, as we know. And we know that plays out profoundly within our own country here in terms of health workforce shortages. We all know that health indicators are down, particularly in the areas of chronic disease, and really across the spectrum of all of our populations. And at the same time, we know our health disparities are up in a country that has such tremendous resources. And again, because I'm a pediatrician, those health disparities include our youth and our adolescent population. Maybe not necessarily the same way, but in other areas. And particularly as they relate to public health, because the three leading causes of death in young people and teenagers are preventable causes: accidents, homicide, suicide. Those are public health issues. Those are not necessarily something I, as a physician, can order a medication to treat. We know that, in terms of what are the determinants of health disparities, we know that they're vast, they're very complicated, but they are in part due to an inadequate workforce. And an inadequate workforce that is culturally diverse and representative of the communities which we serve, and a workforce that really is adequate in terms of primary care representation. We know that African American and Latinos in this country make up about 30% of the U.S. population, yet they account for less than 10% of the physician work shortage. And those numbers have not changed over the past decade or so, and that's pretty much the same in almost every other health profession in this country, which is ridiculous when data shows that race concordancy between a patient and a provider plays a role in positive health outcomes and patient satisfaction. We also know that there are tremendous primary care shortages and maldistribution in this country, and we know that that's going to worsen with the Affordable Care Act. Recently, a study came out that we're expecting tremendous primary care shortages in this country, and we do not have programs or plans in place to address that effectively. The other part of healthcare workforce shortage is we know that currently 5.6 of fourth-year medical students are interested in family medicine. And if you think about all the fields in healthcare that are designated primary care, family practice is really the only one that remains true to generalist medicine, right? If you look at pediatrics, you look at internal medicine, a huge percentage of providers in those fields are going into specialization, and very few of them are remaining in primary care. And that's true in OBGYN too, which is not considered generally a primary care field, but pretty much most OBGYNs are going into surgical specialties or diseases that related to that. The problem with fourth-year medical students who want to go into family practice is that they're facing a tremendous debt burden based upon the tuitions of schools, and we know that there is not only a lack of encouragement, but there's a discouragement from medical faculty for folks to go into family practice. Tremendous cultural problem there. And how that plays out in terms of family medicine slots, residency slots, less than half actually get filled in this country. So we really are facing a tremendous problem in filling the gaps where primary medicine lies. So how can ELAM approach that? Well, this is something that I saw firsthand and was an extraordinary experience for me. We know, first of all, that our ELAM graduates certainly reflect the racial and ethnic diversity of this country, not just in terms of who they are, but actually where they come from as well. Over 50% of ELAM graduates are African American, with the next highest factor being 20%. I challenge any of you to find a medical school in this country that has that demographic profile. Despite years of affirmative action for those that still maintain it, and those that actually have diversity programs, we know that the barriers for students of color in this country to get into medical school programs are tremendous, and it starts much farther down the pipeline, much farther down the pipeline. We also know, and the slide's not included in here, but the vast majority of ELAM graduates articulate at the time of graduation, at the time when they're enrolled, that they want to go into family practice. That is what the Cuban healthcare system trains them to do. That is what they are trained to do. That is what their priority is. So they are a tremendous pool from which we can choose. They reflect their diversity ethnically. They reflect the diversity socioeconomically. And they certainly reflect the priorities that we want our future healthcare providers to do, because they have this intersectorial paradigm that we need to improve our healthcare systems here in this country. The problem is they face tremendous challenges when they come into residency programs in this country. As you can only imagine, the US MLE, the licensing exams, are a tremendous barrier, in part because of the costs involved, as well as the language barriers. If you're trained in Spanish and your vocabulary is in Spanish, and the test oriented in English, it's very hard to be able to interpret and translate that to get what the tests are actually trying to test you for. We know that there's scarce clinical opportunities in the US for many of these ELAM students to actually understand how the system works. There's an off-cycle graduation date that Elam students graduate in late July, and that's already past the deadline for most residency programs, so they actually have a year they have to take off in order to be eligible for the next residency application process. Students and graduate students are essentially unfamiliar with the U.S. graduate medical education process and procedures. We know that it's a whole culture of its own, and you pretty much learn that culture while you're going through medical school here in this country. And if you haven't actually been immersed in that, to jump into that in residency, as you can imagine, creates tremendous barriers. And then essentially residency programs are just unfamiliar with Elam students. They don't know what to do with them. So as a result, MEDIC has created a series of activities and programs which support Elam students, and those are listed there, which include everything from fellowships to help defray the cost of the graduate licensing exams, to the mentorship programs, community connections, the programs which Wright was talking about offered at LME County Hospital, as well as some of our community clinics. The community of Oakland providers who went on this program down back in 2008 actually comprised the body of professionals who provide these services to Elam students. This was a direct result of our experience there, finding out what it was that Elam students needed in order to have effective reentry into this country. Residency outreach, and then something new referred to the pathway to residency. And that's something that I personally have been working with the MEDIC staff in creating. And that is that we want to create a particular program, a transitional year program, where we prepare Elam's graduates who are trying to get into residency programs for entry into residency programs. And we want to cover these topics. These topics were identified by Elam graduates as areas that they needed assistance with. And this was also identified through inputs of our mentors, what we felt Elam students need after having discussion with them. And that included, essentially, an online lecture series about the U.S. healthcare, quote-unquote, system presented by U.S. professionals so that they understand what is this notion of managed care, third-party payer? What is all this when you have free healthcare in Cuba? They have no sense of how that works. And we know that when you're in practice, this is what dictates how we practice, the system, in every sense of the matter. They need clinical experience at both a community clinic and a public hospital system to understand how it is that we practice medicine in this country. Radiology. One of the biggest memories I have was going on rounds with the medical students. And literally, we were in the room, and they were presenting a case. And the way they looked at radiology is you pulled up the x-ray film, held it to a window, so the light shone through, and that was how they were experts at it. It was incredible. I couldn't do that. But they also need to understand the technological advances in this country. Mentorship and presentations from Elam students to our youth in this country, which I'm going to talk about in just a moment. An example of that is one of our Elam graduates came and spoke to young people at the Juvenile Justice Center a few years ago. An African-American young man from this area who spoke to the young men in the Juvenile Justice Center as a sense of providing some sort of role modeling and encouragement that there could be a life other than. This is where I kind of play a role in, because my work is building that pipeline, but much earlier. And when I went down to Cuba, I was thinking, how can we connect those two things? How can we connect the youth who want to enter the workforce with those who are farther up the pipeline? And I'm going to talk with you a little bit about a program I co-created called Faces for the Future, based in Oakland. And essentially, our mission is to inspire young people, particularly at-risk youth from our community, for entry into the healthcare professions and into college so as to change the health outcomes for those young people. I deal with a population, as I said, that is extraordinarily at risk and dying from preventable causes. The imperative for FACES came back in 1999 when we first developed this program, when we were noting really significant increase in violent acuity in our community. Young people dying from violence, suffering from sexual exploitation, tremendous, tremendous, tremendous problems. And at the same time, coming into our clinic, articulating the desire, number one, for change, but also a desire to become healthcare providers. And what we created was a program that really addressed all of those. This gives you a sense of our demographic of the FACES kids. Remarkably, they look very much like the Elam graduates. And we have 70% Latinos, in part because we have programs statewide, many of which are focused in communities that have a very high Latino community. And our program, very much like the Cuban model, is multifaceted. We have four key programmatic strategies, with the most important focusing on psychosocial intervention and case management. It is fine to provide young people with career opportunities to show them exposure, but if you do not give them the psychosocial support and address the barriers, the psychosocial barriers, which keep them off the pipeline, you're not going to get the level of success that you need. So our four parameters are health careers exploration, academic enrichment, wellness support through which psychosocial support is covered, and then youth leadership and development. And our curriculum has clear competencies which address health careers preparation standards, but most importantly, at this age range, we infuse elements of cultural competency, social determinants of health, health disparities to give young people the vernacular and understanding around what is causing such tremendous disparities in our community. And then we also train them for advocacy and community health. So you might take note that this curriculum is not too dissimilar from what Cuba does with our medical students. Our indicators of success are tremendous. Of the 300 plus high school kids that have participated in the program, 100% have remained in it, 100% graduate from high school. Compare that to a 40% graduation rate in Oakland alone. All right. Over 90% are accepted into post-secondary programs, and we have a tremendous number of alumni who are currently in health careers. So I share this with you only because I feel that this is a way that we can connect the pipeline, and for those of you who are personally interested in investing in these efforts, bringing these type of programs into your own community, these are ways that you can really connect the dots. I think that's something that we've all presented here. The face is the young people are a wonderful source of recruitment. They can go through the cycle of actually becoming the ELAM students because they're trained, and in turn, ELAM students have served as mentors and as role models for young people in our program. And currently, the activities that we are in process creating right now are certainly outreach activities, which I told you about, role modeling, mentoring, recruitment, and then some actual shared learning, because ELAM students are already well-versed in the problem-based learning model. It's what they do. They can participate in case studies with our young people. So those are just some general ideas and a quick summary of what we learned. Thank you.
I'd really like to have a discussion, and I also want to introduce and put her on the spot, Marcia. This is what Oakland came up with. Marcia represents one of the participants from Albuquerque, New Mexico, particularly a community called South Valley. And they just got back from their second trip a couple of months ago, and they're in the process. But I also want to say, if there are people in this room who have community coalitions that you feel are strong and need a little shot in the arm for some new inspiration, please contact MEDIC, because we're looking to South Bronx for our next one. We have Milwaukee and Chicago on our minds too. So please contact us if this is something that you think would benefit your community. Marcia, would you stand up?
The trip that I went on was actually last December. It was the first of the two trips from Albuquerque. And I think the thing that just always continues to impress me is how natural it felt there in Cuba. The system makes sense, the way that people do things, because it's based on people's needs. And then I come back home and basically almost feel like I'm in a foreign system, because it doesn't make sense. Like, no matter how long I'm in, it's just even trying to deal with my own family, it's like it doesn't make sense. It doesn't meet my needs as a person or a community. So just that the common sense piece of it when you're there, and so many memories, but one is just, you know, we all went with this idea. We really want to understand how they managed to integrate the medical system and the public health system. And so we asked this question, and almost invariably, you ask the question and people kind of go, you know, like, what do you mean? It's like, there isn't a difference. It's all, because it's already integrated, it doesn't make sense. It's not like they're thinking these are two different things and you have to, you know, put them together. Anyway, we're having lots of fun in Albuquerque finding out how we can learn from this. I mean, we've got all of these different community resources, organizations that are involved. But as many of you know, you can be even in the same neighborhood and not necessarily working together. So this is an opportunity that's really been helping all of these organizations that are right there in the same neighborhood actually think about how we can work together for the good of the community. And it was a wonderful experience, so thank you.
So we'll see what you come up with in 2 years. Questions? Yeah.
First of all, I want to thank the whole team from Alameda County and certainly Albuquerque and Southern California too. What a great initiative. And I have a disconnect, so I'm trying to understand this. And I would like to talk to you afterwards. I'm from Philadelphia, but to talk about Philadelphia. Here's my disconnect. Showing the real integrative services, interdisciplinary, transdisciplinary, what you're doing in Alameda County, BASIS program, going upstream, dealing with what a wonderful interdisciplinary process. And that's what our health system should be. I'm not clear about Cuba and Elam, because everything, and the summer program, everything that seems to be strictly focused on medical students. And my question is, are there opportunities or system, whether it's in Cuba or other places, that could include nurses and PTs and OTs and public health people and health educators and pharmacists and dentists for an integrated system, which clearly what you're trying to do here locally, how does that work as far as it sounds like it's strictly focused on medical students in medical school, both the summer initiative, but maybe not, and certainly the long-term initiative. How can we make this broader, which emulates exactly what you're doing here in the U.S.?
I'll take a stab first. First of all, you just pointed out one of the big differences between Cuba and the U.S. and the training of doctors. And people, I'm a nurse practitioner, and people say, well, don't they have nurse practitioners in Cuba? No. And one reason is that doctors are the guardians of health for a community. So doctors do what public health nurses do, what nurse practitioners do, and some other, I mean, I'm sure they do have physical therapists and occupational therapists and social workers, and that's true. But the concept of a doctor has been so different in Cuba. I had to cut this video, but Melissa, who's the student who's talking, in another part of her talk, talks about going door to door, knocking on people's doors to do health education about dengue. She's a doctor doing that, not a community health worker. Those are just two different paradigms. But I think that is a challenge, because the challenge in these programs is to bring back models that can fit into our system. And so I think we need to think about that. What is the role of a nurse that could be the role of a doctor in Cuba? Or how can we expand the program? Does anybody else want to talk about that? Yeah.
So when we were thinking about the home visiting and their knock-knock program, basically, where they're going door-to-door, for us, we weren't thinking, of course, physicians, you know, being the ones to do that. So we were thinking, okay, this would be our outreach workers, this would be our social workers, case managers. And so we had to translate the function for the physicians that we have here, for the different health professions that we have here, because as Diane mentioned, they're physicians. They do a lot. And so we did meet social workers. So they do have social workers as distinctly different from their physicians. But a lot of the health education, the outreach, community health outreach, those functions are performed by doctors, which would not happen here.
More questions? Comment?
Yeah.
So how does that translate internationally? Because nurses do so much of the caretaking in countries around the world, less economically developed countries around mm-hmm. the world. And so with the Cuban medical school training so many physicians to go to those other countries, is that pushing out the nurses? And I would guess not, because there's so much need in those other countries. But how are they integrating? How are the doctors and the nurses, who the nurses are probably functioning very much like physicians in those countries that have so few doctors? How's that playing out? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay.
Have you seen the film Salud? It's about the Cuban outreach globally in five countries, and it shows the role. Yes, nurses go very heavily involved in the workforce that go to different countries, as are physical therapists, as are teachers, sports medicine, sports coaches. They have a lot of, they definitely are included.
I mean more the locally, the nursing workforce is locally grown and practicing in countries, and then having physicians from the countries who've been trained in Cuba come, when the nurses who've been locally grown in those countries, how do they interact with those physicians?
Is there somebody that wanted to answer that? Somebody from another country that, yeah.
No, but when I went to Cuba, they teamwork.
Yes,
that's what they do. And nurses and pharmacists and doctors all have their first several years of education together.
Right.
So they come, they're better able to work in teams than any doctor in the United States. And even though it's because they get paid $20 a month, and they have a zillion of them. That's why they do this knocking on doors and stuff. They
yeah. Yeah. Just to clarify, the Latin American Medical School is for doctors,
right.
And but the Cuban medical higher medical sciences center that teaches is unified in teaching nurses, physical therapists, doctors, and they work as a team, just like she said. Fred.
Yeah, I was just going to touch on it because I went to medical school in Mexico, and I think Diane. There is that doctors are seen as the gatekeeper. So what you're talking about is a disparity between patient-doctor ratio, and there's even a greater disparity between the nurse and patient ratio. So there's really an imbalance of nursing, and it's just the profession of nursing hasn't gone to the same levels as it has here in the United States. And so that's one of the issues that I guess as far as delivering primary care is that team approach just hasn't matriculated as much as it has in Cuba. So I don't know.
Question.
I live in an indigenous village in Guatemala, and a neighbor was thinking about social work. What kind of social work program would there be in Cuba for her? And how would she handle that?
She's a U.S. citizen?
Oh, no. She's a Mayan.
Oh. Oh. I don't know. The Cuban system does take a lot of people from other countries in all professions, not just medicine. You could contact Medic and we can find out for you.
Good.
I know that through ALOM it's just for medical students, but there are other ways. Yeah. Yes.
Hi, Jim Lloyd from the Cook County Department of Public Health outside of Chicago. I'm really interested in following up, but I have some questions about the embracing the model and the process from Mr. Lassiter and also my colleague in the Department of Public Health. Given that clearly, you know, the outcomes are better, you're addressing racial inequities in the workforce, cost, outcomes, the whole deal. even that it makes so much sense, but the politics of it from the political bureaucratic machinery, what criticism or barriers can you describe that you've overcome? For instance, has media attacked you and you've had to work slowly, or you've worked through positions, as Mr. Lassiter said, kind of educating up? How have you faced that? For instance, I can tell you that I've spoken to administrators who have said, you know, we're in a budget crunch, so we're keeping our heads down. We don't want to be in the news. These kinds of real life on the ground issues that really impede progress, I would say. So that's my question as I return to Chicago.
So I'll start. So I probably have it a little easier because I'm the CEO of the system, right? So, you know, to some extent, just by position, I get to bypass some of that drama. But honestly, I think that frankly, some of my organization, I don't think it was accidental that a number of my physicians kept inviting me to come to. You know, I'm a board member on the Ethnic Health Institute, but I don't get to go a lot because I'm on lots of boards, and so they kept saying, you know, we need you to come and hear these presentations about what's happening in Cuba. And so I said, okay, I'll try to make it, but, you know, initially I wasn't wildly moved to go because I had a lot of competing priorities. And so I don't think it was an accident that they really pushed, you know, the head of our primary care service, you know, literally came to my office and said, listen, I'll drive you to the meeting if you'll go with me, kind of thing. So to get the senior leader engaged, which sort of helps with barriers. And so I guess first thing I would say is, you know, it's really important to find a champion, and then find a champion who's willing to engage, you know, the senior levels of an organization. Because when you do that, then you're able to bypass some of the political barriers you might normally have. I frankly became a cheerleader. And so, leadership, you know, determines a lot based upon what it pays attention to, right? You know, people say the currency of leadership is attention. And so things you pay attention to seem to happen in your organization. If you're gonna run into roadblocks. So this is something where, you know, I've made a purposeful effort to say we'll pay for the students to come and spend the summers with us because there's a value to our organization. And oh, by the way, because I'm so committed to teaching, that I'd like to see these U.S. students who, as Tomas shared with you, have lots of barriers in coming back to the U.S. I want to find a way to sort of grease the skids so that they have opportunities to come back and be productive physicians. It does no good for any of us to have them spend time over there and then not be able to get back to the United States to practice medicine in communities where they want to serve. I guess I would just say you need to find a champion who has the will to find a way to make it happen. And so I don't take credit, you know, for all the things that our organization has done, frankly. I take credit for maybe knocking a few barriers out of the way and telling them to go do it and just, you know, explore as much as you can. And they sort of, you know, put the legs to this and put the substance to it. So, you know, we haven't really faced any external barriers. There hasn't been, you know, the Bay Area is extremely, extremely supportive of social justice, health equity, you know, eliminating disparities. And so if we were in a different part of the country, then maybe I would have some other barriers that I have to deal with. But because of the community here, we haven't faced external barriers. And so then it's really all the barriers you face are just the barriers of devoting time and attention to it and trying to put together something that works and, you know, creating a coalition that will do it. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Help out on
I know there's money coming down to escalate seats to incorporate more utilization of community health workers.
Yeah.
And therefore, that might help out in
Well, you know, I think that if you start with the premise that the Affordable Care Act is aimed at trying to bring, you know, 60-70% of the uninsured into the healthcare system, right? So you take the 50 million folks who are outside the system, and you presume that over a period of time, you're trying to get 60-80% of those folks into a system. You know, that will put significant pressure on the healthcare system, because in many respects we don't have the capacity to care for that many more folks. Kimmy and I, before we started, were looking at some data on the estimates of the uninsured in California post healthcare reform, and looking at a couple models of what that would look like. And I would tell you that in my system, for instance, we're looking at going from a system that cares for about 150,000 people a year to trying to be in position to care for 225,000 people 10 years from now. So it puts pressure on us around how do we get folks who are outside the system, who may be one of the 85,000 ER visits in our system, to be part of the primary care, the medical home systems, who get stratified into intervention based upon their disease state. So for me, it's we're sort of saying, hey, this is an opportunity for the safety net to really try to care for more people. But it's also a situation where we have to do that in a different way. So it's not about building hospital beds. It's really about building the front end of the healthcare system, not more the back end of the healthcare system. So I guess I would maybe start answering the question. I'm not sure I completely answered it, but answering it, from that perspective.
Do you
like
to
I was just going to add that it actually is going to require, and I think this is what you're saying, it's going to actually require that we work more closely together, because in terms of our public health department as well with medical providers, there will be lots of services that people will need to have. And we are dealing with shortages in terms of the number of professionals that are available in our respective systems. And so we're going to have to be very creative about workforce development issues. We're going to also have to be really creative about when we intervene, and intervening earlier and earlier and earlier, because we really just can't afford to wait, and we don't have enough people, professionals, to serve the vast number of people who are actually going to be eligible to receive care in our system. I wanted to just add to, I think the gentleman from Chicago, is it? That, as Wright mentioned, we are very fortunate in Alameda County, in the Bay Area, and in particular in Alameda County, that our political environment really supports and allows for work in this way. And the fact that our public health department has been able to very deliberately embrace a social justice framework and work on upstream policy is unusual for a local health department, to be able to work on transportation, housing directly. So where I believe we are in a somewhat unique situation. So providing portals and doing this, that's actually probably less controversial than some of the other work that we have taken on in terms of really going upstream to look at equity, look at social justice issues, racism, so They were probably thinking, oh, okay, this is easier.
Just a comment about the Affordable Care Act. We think that, well, as I understand it, with the Affordable Care Act, we're going to have recognition and remuneration based on outcomes more than how many patients seen and how many tests you do on the patients that cost a lot of money. So in that way, Cuba, doing a lot with scarce resources, focusing on prevention, and focusing on outcomes, I think is a model that people should really see. You may come back with different take-homes or implement them or adapt them in different ways than the Oakland group, but I think that there are enough creative models and examples there that this program that Medic is running will really be helpful as we try to transition and hopefully have the Affordable Care Act after next Tuesday. Yes?
You've alluded on a number of occasions to the contrast between scarcity and success and outcomes. I just want to highlight that issue. The one trip I took to Cuba, I found it remarkable the contrast between the universal access, the extraordinarily successful outcomes, and scarcities, to give the example of my experience, that had me going back home and sending to one hospital where we had met boxes of thousands of sutures and dozens of asthma inhalers because they didn't have access. And I relate that example to ask the following question. We in this country, I think, have come to understand that prevention is important. The kind of integrated approach that you folks talk about is important. And yet, economically, in terms of where the power is and the influence is, we measure our success by how many MRI machines we have, by how many PET scanners we have, by how much high tech we have. And I think part of our experience is that we can't succeed nationally in the kinds of things that you folks are pursuing and that I applaud enormously for so long as we as a country can't get out of the business of measuring success by how much high tech we have. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you could comment on that contrast and whether you can succeed nationally in a culture where these very expensive devices are so primary and it's very, very expensive treatment is so primary.
Who wants to answer that? By the way, has anybody seen Escape Fire, the film?
What's the name of that?
Escape Fire.
Escape Fire.
I want to plug two films, and then I want somebody else to answer that question, because that's a... But Escape Fire, it's... Andrew Weil is heavily... he's one of the narrators, and it addresses exactly what you're talking about, along with the insurance companies, and we're caught in a system, and how do we get out? The other film I really want to plug is called The Waiting Room, and it's a recent release about the Highland Hospital waiting room, filmed in 24 hours, and it is excellent. And when it comes to your town, or look for it on the web, just Google The Waiting Room, and you can actually arrange a showing in your community. Now for the question, the answer.
I think I'll start because I think Timmy and Tomas will both point at me, so I'll start trying to answer that question. So just for the bottom line, can we be successful given the orientation of our healthcare system? I think the answer is absolutely yes, we can be. Because I think we're seeing success in our local communities across the country. However, we still have a structural problem here, and our structural problem is our healthcare system is oriented to a ticker, you know, clicking off a ticker and a fee-for-service mode that, whether it's, you know, fee-for-service in the private sector or even fee-for-service in the federally qualified health center sector, where in order to get reimbursement to pay for your doctors and staff, you have to ring a bell. And so that does create barriers at times when you say, you know what, for some diabetic care, having 10 people come to a group visit is better than having those 10 individuals come individually to see a doctor, you know, 10 separate times. So it's going to require, you know, some time for there to be some reorientation of our healthcare system away from fee-for-service and really focused on population basis. Because, frankly, the reason that there aren't more incentives around managing chronic disease longitudinally is because people aren't incented, generally speaking, to manage populations. They're incented to manage episodes of care. But that doesn't mean we still can't be successful. You can't carve out ways to be successful, whether it's initiatives like this, you know, whether it's communities that come together and put together proposals to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Intervention, CMMI, where there's, you know, $10 billion that's been approved that irrespective of next Tuesday is still going to be there to support innovation in changing how care is delivered and improving cost effectiveness. So I think those are things that can help. And I agree with you on the notion of the overuse of technology, but I wanted to make sure we don't go too far to sort of blasting technology, because there's newer technology that I think will become much more effective than some of the, you know, not the MRIs and the PET scanners and that sort of stuff. But, you know, in the last few weeks, I've seen, I spent some time with a physician whose name is Eric Topol, who heads up translational medicine at Sharp down in San Diego. Very different sort of discussion what we're having now, except to say that there's technology out now whereby, you know, we worry oftentimes with many of our patients who don't have good compliance with medication, and so that has significant health outcomes. Well, they've developed a pill with nanotechnology that you swallow a pill when it hits gastric acid, that chip begins transmitting back to your doctor, to a website that your doctor can monitor drug levels. And so when you're worried about, well, geez, my patient who has not been compliant, has he or she taken their meds? Well, you know what? You swallow that little pill and boom, the doc or the pharmacist or the nurse can go and sort of see how well that patient is doing. And when the drug hits the body, how does it spike? And are you getting the kind of medication coverage you should? He showed us a similar technology with a little thing that goes in the back of your iPhone where you can put your fingers on what look like two electrodes, and it produces an ICU-like monitor of a lot of physiologic conditions. And so again, so the notion of, you know, does that work in every population? Well, the answer is no. Everyone doesn't have an iPhone, obviously. But that kind of technology sort of says, well, how can we really monitor a population's health without you having to come to a doctor's office? Because we're not going to have consultorios in every community in the next 20 years, right? So that model might not work in the United States, but what are other models that we can adapt? So I clearly think we have opportunities to take advantage of a lot of things. I don't think we have to wait for fundamental and radical upheaval in our healthcare system to take advantage of more. But is it likely for that to spread across the entire country? Probably not. It's going to be these seeds of innovation in communities that are frankly more progressive and more willing to sort of push the envelope. And then over time, I think you'll see more of this spreading across the United States. Long answer to a short question.
Well, thank you very much. Are there any other one last question? Or yes.
How can we get access to the PowerPoints that were so great?
They're available via the Essential Learning, and if you don't have the Essential Learning, then perhaps Diane would be willing to email them.
Yeah, definitely. Well, thank you. Thank you to everybody who came. Get home safely.